This is Michael McLaughlin from VerinoCast, and it's my pleasure to be speaking to Brooklyn's very own chocolate genius, otherwise known as Mark Anthony Thompson, whose latest release, Black Yankee Rock, is one of 2005's best albums. How you doing, Mark?
Good, man. I'm a lot better. I was looking for the corkscrew a minute ago, so I'm glad that the interview gave me a little time to find my corkscrew. I'm good.
Glad to hear. What are you drinking there tonight?
Oh, I got a nice little Chilean Cabernet. Chile is kind of surprising with their red wines right now, but it's good.
Wow, that's cool.
We'll find out in a minute, buddy. This interview, I'll tell you how good it is.
Okay. So you've said that Black Yankee Rock is a culmination of a trilogy, 1998's Black Music and 2001's God Music being the first two acts. Can you tell me what's the concept behind the trilogy?
Well, I had been reading this this series of books by Lawrence Durrell called The Alexandria Quartet, and I was really fascinated with trying to string along more than one book with these characters, and each of his books is taken from a different character's perspective. I wasn't that ambitious, but I still thought if I could string out these characters in my stories for about three records, it would be a great experience. I wanted to end all the records with the word music and just change the setting on each of them sonically. So we did the first record, which was a nighttime record, which we did that in an analog studio. It was a very warm record. Then the next record, we went out in the snow and did it in a digital rig, which we worked fairly quickly, played with the studio a lot. And then this record, we kind of did a combination of both. We started in a real warm setting on the East Coast, and then we went back to the West Coast and mixed it. I don't know, it's kind of incestuous, because not only are these characters I'm singing about the same, it's the same, I get the same people to play on the records most of the time, so I don't know, that's another thing that ties this whole trilogy together.
That's interesting, because, I mean, it definitely, listening to the albums, you can hear the sort of the sonic progression that you just mentioned. I mean, I definitely hear Black Music is sort of a more sparse place, and then God Music's a little fuller, and I think this record's, you know, much fuller than the other two, you know, for me.
Yeah, you know, it's so hard to not be reactionary to stuff that you're doing, and, you know, after Black Music came out, and, you know, you gotta realize Black Music was, it wasn't necessarily written in a pretty dark place, but I was going through a lot of stuff. I'd just gone through a really big breakup. My mom was really ill, and I was kind of just, I was just getting rid of a lot of ghosts, you know. And so when I did interviews for that record, I was really surprised that people expected me to be this really dark, sad character. And so I think as a reaction to that, God Music, you know, we kind of wanted to rock out a little bit and just let people know that, you know, you're not always the I you're singing about in these songs, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, go ahead.
You know, I'm just saying it's just people forget about the license of a storyteller sometimes, and, you know, you sing in the first person, and you're likely just to fall into that whole confessional singer-songwriter thing. You know?
And it's interesting with you, because I've had the privilege of seeing you a few times when I lived down the city, and your live act is completely different than the records. I mean, obviously you're singing the same songs, but, you know, you're just one of the funniest MFs I've ever seen on stage.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. You know, the whole Chocolate Genius thing originally was nothing but a live act. You know, I was in another band called Hope is a Muscle with Dougie Bound and Yuka Honda. And then Yuka went on to form a band called Chiba Mata at the same time that we were kind of getting started. And Dougie went on to play with a really amazing musician named Chris Whitley. So the Chocolate Genius idea just kind of came out of me sitting around in New York with all these great musicians around and having a lot of time, because my band was kind of splintering up. And so originally it was just a live act. We didn't plan to record. We didn't do anything. The cool thing about Chocolate Genius was I would take all these great musicians and put them on different instruments. So like Mark Nebo played trumpet in the original Chocolate Genius, and I had a great drummer named Sim Kane playing guitar. I had Yuka Honda playing bass. You know what I mean? It was a really, and because all these musicians were really great, everybody had a great sense of rhythm, but it was pretty cacophonous. So I would just tell jokes, you know, that's kind of how the stage act came together. I would tell jokes and we'd play for a bit, then I'd keep telling jokes. And I think, you know, a lot of the nervousness, a lot of the humor and the patter on stage, it's just really because I'm kind of nervous. I mean, the live thing for me is just like a pretty scary experience. Sometimes I wish we did sound more like the record, but I'd probably get bored with that anyway.
I have no complaints about your live shows. I think the interesting thing about Chocolate Genius is that the shows vary so greatly. You know, I haven't seen you... I saw you the night that Stu opened up for you down at Tonic,
uh-huh.
and that was when the most smoking soul bands I've ever seen. That all black band you had that night was like just blew me away.
Yeah, it's really fun to. I mean, I'm lucky, man. I'm in a place where, like, a lot of musicians know what I do. I wish more people. I wish more people that actually buy records knew what I do. But I have a great, like, you know, phone book and a great bunch of people that I call friends to play with from time to time. And it's just fun to mix it up sometimes. Like, you know, the last time we played Joe's Pub, we had like the Scorchio strings and we had a really big horn section. It was just great. And then we strip it down and, you know, the next night I'm playing with just a Hammond organ and a drummer, you know, so it's interesting to flip it up. That's really just me trying to keep from getting bored. I can't understand how people can just like do the same set over and over and, you know, do the songs the same way. It's like, I would just go crazy.
It's all about the money, right?
I don't know. I've never been in that situation. Hopefully one day I'll be able to tell you, yes, it is all about the money and I have some in my pocket. But you know, until I get some, I won't really know what it's like.
Let me know too. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about a few of the tracks on the latest record, Black Country Rock. My first is, what is and who might be a tomboy rock star?
You know, man, that's funny because that song, sometimes these songs, you know, I was reading this the other day. I read this interview with Tricky, and he was talking about how he kind of just goes into his head, spits this stuff out, and then he figures it out. It comes to him later. He can look at the lyrics later, and he might have no idea what it's about until the song has lived for a while. Tomboy Rockstar, when I wrote it, I was writing it. It was kind of like a play on words a little bit because I was kind of thinking of Uncle Tom. I was also thinking of my dear friend Michelle Ndigicello, who I wanted to play on that song with me, and I was teasing her about being a tomboy. And then I kind of was just playing with the idea of rock stars and what rock stars in this day and age are and how Arnold Schwarzenegger is a governor and, you know, what's the other guy, Jesse Ventura, and you got the guy from Nirvana now running for office, and it's just, you know, Paris Hilton. It's just the whole idea of celebrity has gone pretty askew, and I kind of wanted to play with that for a bit. There's also kind of a lot of the lyrics are kind of slanted towards whatever the wherever hip hop has gone. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was just playing with just playing with words for a lot of it. You know, I love the idea of like whistling at the dentist's office. You know, when your mouth is, you know, as far away as you can get from whistling. But I think the tomboy rock star probably in everybody's head, they're going to take a different thing away from that song. Some people think it's gibberish.
Yeah,
I read an interview somewhere that said I was like very white to teenagers. You know, so I don't know.
Yeah,
it's
go ahead. I was going to say, you know, listening to that, I'm wondering, like, Courtney Love?
I love Courtney Love. Actually, I'm one of the few people that actually likes Courtney Love, you know. But it's every time we do it, I change the lyrics, so, because it's just you know, it's still that kind of song. We have another song on the first record called Hangover Number 9 that I just change the lyrics every night, too. You know, as long as you get to the chorus, you can just say Tomboy Rockstar, and that's really all it's about.
Yeah. That's cool. Two of the songs on the record that are quite striking, you know, as a dichotomy are Rats Under Waterfall and It's Going Wrong. I don't think that you could have two songs that just seem like further apart in the emotional spectrum. Could you talk about those a little?
Rats Under Waterfalls was I had a demo of that I did by myself. I just want to say two things about the last record so you kind of understand the climate that we made it in. We went to record that song the day after the elections. So the day after George Bush was elected president, we were headed to the studio. So that kind of, that permeated. I knew that either he was gonna, if he won or lose, it was going to be a completely different recording experience. I knew it was going to be this joyous thing, or it was going to be this kind of thing where we were trying to forget what was really going on. And so by the time we got in the studio, we really went through a lot of trials and tribulation to get everybody there. Because we have a crew that's pretty much from all over the world. At that time, Abe had been playing with Paul McCartney. He flew in to do the record. He only had a really brief little period of time. Michelle was like in Washington, D.C., and then she was doing gigs in New York. So she drove up every day to record and then had to drive back down. So I didn't want to go in there with this agenda and then be disappointed because, you know, I had an agenda that I didn't meet. So what I did was I took about 30 songs to the studio, and each morning we'd wake up and I'd play songs for the musicians that were there, and we kind of chose songs. I was really surprised that Rats in the Waterfall was one that everybody kind of like had a certain affinity for and they really wanted to tackle. It came out, it has the spirit of my demo, really. It's really close to the spirit of my demo, but it kind of came out a lot more whimsical, kind of, I won't say Brian Wilson-y, but it kind of had a much more whimsical spirit that kind of matched where the lyrics were. When in the original demo, it was a really kind of a sad song. And It's Going Wrong was a much more soulful song on the first track that I got, on the Moby demo. I don't know, dichotomy, I guess? the whimsical thing, it's really funny because, you think Rats Under Waterfalls is a pretty whimsical song, but it's still a pretty... It's still a New York, it's such a New York song to me,
Mm-hmm.
They don't really get rats on the West Coast.
Well, they might be in the human form.
Exactly. They call them field mice out there.
Agents. There's definitely with, you've sort of visited that in the last record, too, with Boss Man Piss on My Lemonade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a really fun song. That's one of the only songs on the last record that was a demo. That I did by myself, and then we just kind of like we tried to record it again. We did Boss Man about two or three different ways, and we always went back to the demo and thought the demo had a spirit that we couldn't capture. So I just ended up putting the demo out.
One of the things that is sort of I find so interesting about your songs, it's I described it as sort of a tearjerk, And having seen you play to Christina Aguilera's "Beautiful" live, I was just so struck by it because. I did like that song, but to see somebody else do it and, mature older man do it compared to her version, it was just really striking. And when I was listening to this album, listen the same time tomorrow, I just think that if you could get somebody like Christina Aguilera or Kelly Clarkson to cover that, you might get that money that you were alluding to earlier.
I've always thought that sometimes because my voice is kind of, I'm like a stylist. I'm not like a singer per se. I'm not like a Bilal or just somebody who's going to open their mouth and you're going to go, "Whoa, my God, this guy's singing his ass off." But I think I write good songs. I've always thought it'd be interesting to do a record of my songs sung by real singers, because then people could get past whatever stylist things bother them about the vocals. Because I read online all the time and I hear some comments about my voice that are just like, "Oh my God," people are. People do have trouble getting by it. It seems like a very polarizing instrument, and I think some of the songs could definitely live further. There was a song on the last record called "Eyes of the Lord" that I thought straight up, could have been like a, had it been sung by someone like an Al Green or somebody, people would have gone, "Oh, this is a great song." But then on my record, people look at it and go, "Oh, this is funny." You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I guess I'll forever be running from the big money if I open my mouth.
You mentioned Michelle Andicello and how she played on this record. And I know that you guys often played live down there in New York. I'm wondering, ever a chance you guys might do a full-blown project together?
We've talked about it. Michelle really wants to produce. She wanted to produce the last record. She's I'd like to do something with her. It's the same thing with whenever you work with great musicians, it's that kind of thing where it's like it's just about schedules.
Yeah.
It's really about schedules. There's always a desire there. And I'd like to do a full-blown, another record project with Mark Rebo. I'd love to do something with Michelle. I'd love to do something full-blown with Michelle. And there's a lot of friends of mine I'd like to record with.
What did you think of Comfort Woman?
Comfort Woman, I like all her records. Yeah, I like Comfort Woman. I was a little surprised by it because I had been touring with her right before that record, so I heard a lot of the songs. As she was developing them, I heard a lot of them live, and then the actual record came out. It was kind of a departure from what I thought was going to be just from seeing them live a lot,
Yeah. How'd you get Van Dyke's Park to play in the record?
I just sent it to him. I got his phone number from the head of my label who knew his agent, and they said he's really, picky about what he does, and he's kind of a cantankerous old guy, but just send it to him, and we'll start there. And it was really funny because I sent him the record, and then I called him because I had heard that he liked it, and I called him, and he didn't know who I was when I called him. So I called, and he was just really kind of standoffish and didn't had no idea who I was or what I was calling him for. And then when I finally mentioned Chocolate Genius in the record, he just lit up, and it was like such a cool thing because I've been a fan of his for a really long time, and not just his the stuff he's done arrangement-wise, but he has some solo records that I really like. He had a record called Tokyo Rose where he was singing, and I got to see him live once in L.A. doing that record with an orchestra, and I just was really a fan of his whole thing, not just his arrangements. So it was just it was really great to meet him. We went to his house to work on the arrangements, and it just, you got to just remember remember that you're there to work and just not listen to all the great stories that he's got, you know.
Yeah, I was going to ask if it was intimidating being around a musical mind like that.
It was a little intimidating because, you know, you can't, when you call someone like Van Dyke Parks, you call him because he's Van Dyke Parks and you just let him do what he does. And so when he's asking for feedback, I don't know what to tell him, you know what I mean? I'm like, well, it sounds okay, you know. But yeah, it was a little intimidating because, for instance, like, if you heard the original version of that song, it was much, Van Dyke came in and it just all of a sudden turned into another creature. I had to actually go back and re-sing it after he put the strings on. So, yeah, it was, I mean, he's open, though, because he just wants to do the right job for you. We had no concerns for a label. He wasn't working on something that was a giant budget. He wasn't working on something that we knew was going to be some, you know... that's the cool thing, you know. I mean, I'm not going to say a cool thing, but the thing about not having a very large audience is I don't have anyone to please, really. You know what I mean? I don't have to worry about the end result in terms of what niche we're hitting or what, you know, if we're living up to whatever we were supposed to be living up to, because no, you know, we just kind of work the way we work. So it was kind of liberating in that way working with Van Dyke, because I didn't have to. He's just great. You didn't have to direct him at all. I was just here, you know. And then he wanted to do more, so I asked him to play accordion on another song, and he was down for that. I wish we would have had more time. I would have loved to have written with him, you know, because just when he sat down and we just played piano and stuff, with just all these ideas. And I know he's into that stuff. You know, I know he's really into collaborating on that level. We just ran out of time. We actually worked with him when we were mixing the record. We flew to L.A. to mix the record, and then during our mix sessions, he did an arrangement and just came in and brought his players.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, being bi-coastal, you know, because from what I understand, you were raised in California, and you're praised in New York City. There's a duality there that I can kind of hear expressed in your music, and I see it in the videos. For instance, in the latest EPK you have, I saw the Crenshaw Boulevard sign.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get, you know, what's your take on East Coast versus West Coast?
You know, man, it's all the cliches you hear about East Coast, West Coast are true for a reason, because they're really cliches. I have a house on the West Coast. I have family out there on the West Coast. An outdoor kind of person. I grew up, you know, surfing and playing tennis and stuff, and I missed that part of Los Angeles. But culturally, it's just so rich back here, and I've gotten so used to seeing the seasons change. I hate automobiles. I love being back here and laughing as I hear about the price of gas going one way or the other. So I don't know. I find it's nice to. I'm really glad I know both. I don't think I would love either city as much if I didn't have the other one to escape to. But I can't imagine doing what I do on the West Coast. There's just too much good music here, and too many good musicians, and it's more of a wide open ear and audience for music here. I don't know. Maybe it's happening on the West Coast, and I just don't know about it. But there's just a different urgency here, and there's just a different rhythm to everything that I just find completely vital to what I do, you know. It's inspiring daily.
So, are you in the two-pack of the Biggie camp?
Biggie.
Biggie?
Yeah, I'm about 3 blocks from his neighborhood right now, where I live.
I was going to ask you about Fort Greene. What does that bring in the music, and how do you feel about its so-called pending gentrification?
Oh, man, it's like... It's been a sore topic for a long time. I mean, it's the kind of thing where I'm seeing all these families get moved out, and all these churches that have been around forever now are being bought, and all these temples are turning into condos, and, you know, rent is like just about double since I've been here in the last 8 years. But on the other hand, you know, I can walk a block to a really good French restaurant, and, you know, now I can buy wine without having to go to the city. So I guess it's got its ups and downs. I don't own land here, so I'm not as affected by it on the positive tip. Like, I've seen a lot of my friends who own property here. They got in at a good time, and they're reaping the benefits from it. For me, it's just this bad thing because I'm not on the side of landowners. Period. So it's a shame to just see families moved out and to see the demise of a real, real working community turn into it. You know, the other thing too is one of the other factors. The other thing that September 11th brought to it, all of a sudden Brooklyn and my neighborhood in particular became extremely attractive to people that had been living on the, you know, in lower Manhattan. So a lot of businesses moved out here, and a lot of people moved here. You know, people just got scared of the lower Manhattan for a while, but it's funny, you know. I don't know. I think I'll be going back to California for a while, or maybe even moving farther east if I can for a little bit. I think my New York experience, it's a nice place to know, and I love it. I'll always know it, but I think it's time for a change, you know.
Yeah, I had a similar experience, having been in San Francisco in the early 90s. They gentrified the Lower Haight down there. And it always seems that when that goes down, they're just bleeding the color out of the neighborhood.
Absolutely. So that's a big part of why I was so excited to do that movie, Everyday People. I mean, that's a really big part of that movie. There's even a quote in that movie, you know, you can't take all the color out and not lose the flavor, you know.
Yeah. Speaking of that movie, I was wondering, are you going to go for any more film roles? I believe that when I watched that, I saw you street busking with your acoustic guitar in a scene, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. That was the director's idea. I didn't go into that as, you know, thinking that I'd be in a movie or have any aspirations to be in a movie. I read for a movie recently that I kind of thought was going to be a good experience because T-Bone Burnett was working on it, but that's a whole other world, man. You know, it's a whole other world. It's like, I don't know. If some project came along, it was cool, and somebody wanted me to be me, and it wasn't too nerve-wracking, I guess I'd pursue it. But, no, being on the side of the camera is a strange experience, you know.
I remember seeing you on I think it was IFC on that video, like this odd video thing. You were the host for that, weren't you? Like,
oh yeah, that stuff's fun to do. I did that for a few shows. I did that was called Sonic Cinema, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that was a trip. I mean, that was all right to do. You know, they wanted someone that was kind of knew a little bit about music and could improvise a bit. That was fun. Then I hosted another show for PBS, where I got to travel around. It was kind of like a roving reporter. That was kind of fun as well, because they let me be me, but, you know, it's, the acting thing is a whole different world. I got to change phones with you.
Okay.
Yeah, I just did, so we're okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, with the, you know, your current canon of songs, is there any, you know, particular song of songs that you feel like that's the essence of what it is you do? I mean, I know that's kind of a difficult question, but, you know, if you were to look at what you've done so far, you could say, you know, man, you know, this song or these songs are the ones.
You know, I don't know, man. I mean, I always hope the next batch of songs is going to be what the one is. And that's the trick, you know, with releasing records in the kind of, you know, because regardless of how renegade, you know, I am or try to be, it's still, when you're in, like, you know, you sign to a record label and, you know, people give you $150,000 to make a record, they're going to want you to go promote that record. So, you know, unless you're able to, like, I dug how the White Stripes did their last record, where they did it pretty quickly, got out there and released it maybe like a week or so after it was done. Because then you can kind of move with the sort of urgency that you recorded something with. You can keep your excitement. But, you know, you record these records, you mix these records, you talk about these records, you go tour these records. You know, you got to stay fresh with that shit. You'll do it too. You know, you'll do it until you forget what you even liked originally about a song. So I just try to keep writing. So I'm always hoping that the next thing I do or the last thing I did is, like, you know, the culmination of where I'm going or the essence of where I'm going. I don't know, you know. I'm not really sure. That's a hard question. It changes me day to day. I don't really listen to the records too much after we do them. So I guess I have to go back and listen to them and figure out what hit the nail on the head. I think there's some songs on the last record that at the time I thought were really kind of capturing something. Like, there's a song called Glorious that I thought was pretty, you know, I thought it was where we were at the time. And I guess on the new record, what would I say? I don't know. I kind of like, I like Amazon on the new record. I think that's kind of like where we'd be. Even I say that's funny. I say that song, but it's a song we've never done live. So it's like, it's funny. It's like, I'm so proud of it. I never do it. you know, I don't know.
I would think a song I'd like to ask you about, you know, is My Mom. I mean, you described that black music was a difficult time. I mean, that's just a heart-wrenching video, and that song is just a slayer. And I just wonder, is that difficult to play?
You know, well, the story with that song is, and I've told the story before, it's like, we had finished the record. The record was done. We finished recording the record. It was literally the last day of recording. And I was trying to talk the label into letting me direct my own music video. You know, they said they were going to give me a budget for a music video. And they started talking about how they wanted to do it. And I had written that song, My Mom, a while ago. I'd done just a version of it with me on a pump organ, and I'm like an amateur filmmaker, so I'd made a short film with that song in it, and I went into the label, and I showed them the song and the video, because I just wanted them to see that I could make films. I wasn't at all thinking about the song, and they were like, fuck the song, man. You know, I mean, fuck the video. Like, this is a really great song. You should record it. And I'd never really thought about putting something that bare naked and that close to the truth out, you know. Mm-hmm. So I called my dad, and I asked him how he felt about it, because I didn't want him to feel like I was pimping my mom's situation or, you know, at that point I wasn't really looking to, like, you know, connect the dots for people with Alzheimer's or, you know, I wasn't looking at it in any sort of a, like, universal thing. I just thought this was a very personal thing to me. And my dad was like, no, it seemed fine, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I played the song for the band at the last night of recording. We were sitting down eating. And we just went back in and did that version. We did it twice, and that's the second version that you hear, the one we released. So it was like I never really thought about what it was going to be like to have that song out. It didn't really hit me, you know, until I got out in public, and all of a sudden people were screaming out for that song, you know. And it was like, it was kind of, at first it was really hard to do. It was really, really hard to do, because I'd be in some club, I'd be feeling great, and then all of a sudden I have to sing the song about my mom being sick, you know, and it would just kind of bring me down. So we always, you know, I'd have to put it at the end of the set because I found that it was pretty hard to go on after doing that song. And then I just stopped doing it altogether. We played somewhere in New York. We played a place called Fez. And there was this woman, and she was really, really drunk. And she was in the front of the audience. And all through the set, every time we stopped playing, she screamed out, "My mom." She just kept screaming it out and screaming it out. And it was just, I mean, Abe could tell. He could just tell it was really, because my mom at that point, she was near death, you know, and it was just hard. It was just brutal. And so I decided then to never do the song, and we didn't do it again for 2 years. And then one night I just pulled it out, and it was just, it was the greatest experience. It was just like this powerful moment where I felt like my mom was with me, and I was just thinking about all the great things about her, and she was just in the club at that moment. And then I got a really great letter from a teenage girl in, like, somewhere in Wisconsin or something, you know, that had seen the video on MTV2, and she just thanked me for it and told me how much it was like, you know, her and her, she was going through this with her grandmother. And then I got a few more letters like that. And then I got a DVD from someone called Portable Amnesia about their mother. And people were asking me, could they use the song? And I felt this incredible, like, I don't know, I just felt like this universal connection on some strange level, because I realized that a lot of people, I'd articulated something for a lot of people. And then it became a source of power. I don't do the song now just because I've done it so many times that sometimes I don't want it to fall into this thing where it's like, you know, Tony Bennett and losing his heart in San Francisco, but it's inevitably the song that people, you know, if we get an encore, that someone's going to scream that out, you know. Yeah. And I'm touched by that. I'm glad, you know, I'm glad, but it's not the sad thing that it once was for me, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask you about is, you know, I know you played with Chris Whitley, you know, both on and off record, and I wondered, you know, with his recent passing, is there a memory you'd share with us?
You know, man, Chris was just one of these guys, man. Chris was one of these guys that when you got the call about Chris, you know, it was like, you know, if someone called you and said, Mark Rebo is the one that said this, if someone called you and said, hey, did you hear about Chris? You know, there was no doubt, you know, what it was about. It was, can you hang on 1 second?
Sure.
Okay. You know, when you got the call and someone said, have you heard about Chris, you knew it wasn't, you know, oh, did he win a Grammy? Did he? Because Chris had been like kind of a walking ghost for quite a while, you know. And I don't know if that goes along with the depth of his talent and the depth of his gift, because, you know, he was without a doubt like one of the most gifted people that I know. And I can say that from, you know, not from afar. It's not like I saw him once or twice. I toured with him at least twice and got to see him every night, you know, for month after month. I knew him, you know. So it's like, it's kind of close, man. It's kind of close to talk about Chris in that way. Now, I don't have any, like, cute stories or anything that's, you know, any aside about Chris, except for that I really miss him, and I hope upon hope that, you know, his music will last as long as it deserves to last. And it's just a shame that he wasn't able to enjoy, you know, the depth of his gift, because he was just he was in a lot of pain, man, but he made some great records. He made some records that definitely changed my life and that continue to change my life. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I would agree. I greatly enjoyed his work, and I found that his episode of his career track was one of the more interesting ones to, you know, not having known the man, but watch it from afar. It was interesting.
Absolutely. It was totally inspiring, man. He was fearless, and, you know, he was just like Miles Davis. He could just, like, keep his essence no matter what sort of, you know, what sort of idiom he put his music in. It was always Chris, and he just sang and played with such a... He was just so serious.
Cool.
So serious. He would come and heckle me sometimes when he'd be loaded, because, you know, Chris was really shy. I mean, he was either, you know, mumbling quietly about, you know, aw shucks, or he was just, like, loaded out of his mind and speaking in tongues, you know. And the last few times I saw him, he was in the speaking in tongues mode, and it was something to behold either way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My last question for you is, rumor has it that you're going to retire the Chocolate Genius name. So, well, what's next if you're going to retire the Chocolate Genius name?
You know, I haven't thought it ahead that far. I just know that we signed on, you know, I signed on in my mind to do three of these records, and I'm not sure what I want to do next, but I think we got one more Chocolate Genius Incorporated record in us, and then we'll take it from there, you know.
Cool. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, man.
Good luck with whatever you're going to go with down the road, and I hope I get to see you sometime up here in the northern New England area.
Is that where you are?
I'm in southern Maine, actually.
Okay.
But I live, you know, fairly close to Boston.
Cool.
So, yeah, I'm actually a former, I guess, music journalist, but I'm back in school now. So.
Where are you going to school?
I go to school in University of Southern Maine.
Cool, man. Hey, well, good luck to you, man.
Thank you. Thank you. Hey, I wanted to ask you, I'm off the topic, but did you ever hear of Gene McDaniels? You ever hear that cat?
Yeah, but why?
Well, he hit a couple early 60s hits, like 100 Pounds of Clay.
Oh, absolutely, sure, yeah.
Do the Road Feel Like Making Love.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
I thought he was an old dude, yeah.
Yeah, I actually interviewed him this morning. I've been doing interviews for like about 6 years, and I interviewed two of you guys today because he's actually a neighbor of mine up here, and I found out about him. I was just curious if you were aware of the guy.
I know that song, 100 Pounds of Clay, and of course I don't feel like making love.
Yeah, he was an interesting guy, man.
Cool, man.
All right, well, hey, Mark, thank you very much, and I do wish you the best. I hope I get to see you up this way at some point.
All right, Michael.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye.